From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the science of cooking and the chemistry of taste and smell. We hear part two of our interview with Harold McGee. He's updated his popular book on food and cooking. Also, we meet writer Miriam Taves. One reviewer describes her new novel, A Complicated Kindness, as a kind of catcher in the rye for Mennonite girls. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Rammer Jammer Yellowhammer, A Journey into the Heart of Fan Mania, by New York Times writer Warren St. John. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premieres of Alias and 24. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The more you know about why foods behave the way they do, the science of cooking, the more you will understand about how to prepare a good food. That's the premise of Harold McGee's book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. It was first published in 1984 and was described in Time magazine as a minor masterpiece. L.A. Times food columnist Russ Parson calls it the single best book in its field, and Vogue magazine food critic Jeffrey Steingarten says it changed the way we cooks think about and do things in the kitchen. Now McGee has written a new edition that includes the latest information about the science of cooking, takes into account new food trends, and explains the chemistry of flavor and taste. We played part one of my interview with McGee before the holidays. Now we'll hear part two. He says that most of what we perceive as flavor really comes from our sense of smell. I asked him to explain that, since I perceive taste as coming from my tongue, not my nose. He told me it's really a matter of numbers.
We have receptors on our tongue that can detect a half dozen or so different kinds of molecules. And so we have a half dozen or so different kinds of sensations that come from the tongue. Sweetness, sourness, bitterness, umami, a Japanese term that refers to the flavor, is a very specific taste of MSG, monosodium glutamate. In the nose, though, we've got hundreds of different receptors that can detect thousands of different kinds of molecules. And so the tongue, in a way, kind of lays down the basis for a flavor in a food, gives you kind of the backbone of the flavor, but then the complications and the distinctiveness comes from the hundreds of compounds that are responsible for the aroma.
Even when there isn't a discernible aroma from what we're eating?
Well, there's a difference between what you can smell by sniffing a food on your plate and what you can smell from the aromas that come from inside your mouth across your olfactory receptors in the nose from inside. Of course, the mouth is a very enclosed place, and so things can get concentrated there, whereas if it's sitting on your plate, you know, the aromas are going in all directions, and you may only get a tiny fraction of what's available.
In your book, you say that an exception to the rule that much of our taste really comes from our sense of smell, an exception to that is hot spices like hot peppers. How do we sense them?
Chili peppers actually activate not a taste receptor, but a receptor that's really responsible for creating the sensation of pain. And that's a very peculiar thing that human beings have come to enjoy and treasure and seek after flavors that actually do cause us pain and do that because they're meant to deter us from eating. The other thing is that apparently the compounds that cause those sensations also heighten our sensitivity to certain other tastes. So, for example, saltiness and sourness become much more pronounced in the presence of the compounds that give hot peppers their heat.
While we're talking about aroma, it seems to me that the place that's really using the latest knowledge about aroma and how that enhances taste is the fast food industry. Because aren't they really chemically studying that and consciously using chemicals that literally enhance fragrance and also enhance taste?
Yes, one of the driving forces to understanding about more about flavor has been a desire to not exactly make better foods, but to approximate them by other means. So instead of making, say, a traditional cheddar cheese the old-fashioned way, which is very labor-intensive and takes months of aging in order to develop the flavor, cheese companies are interested in knowing, well, what are those flavors that are in the final cheese that give it its wonderful qualities, and can we get them in there some other way faster?
Do you know what chemically is going on in the flavor of cheddar cheese and how you can chemically enhance cheese to make it taste like a good cheddar?
Well, the way cheese and many other traditional slowly made and especially fermented foods get their flavor is essentially from the breakdown of the original food materials. So, for example, in the case of cheddar cheese, it's made from milk, and milk is mainly fat and protein. And those molecules in themselves don't really have flavor. They're way too big. They don't. They can't escape into the air and affect our sense of smell. What happens in the course of cheese making is that various microbes, mostly bacteria in the case of cheddar cheese, break those flavorless kind of precursor molecules down into their building blocks, amino acids and fatty acids and things like that. And it's those things that then interact with each other and with our senses of taste and smell and give us the impression of a kind of mouth-filling flavor. And the way to get that quickly is to find ways to accelerate that breakdown or to add those small flavorsome molecules from the very beginning so that you don't have to wait.
Your book explained a lot to me about how fruits ripen and why I sometimes am lucky and sometimes not with that. Can you explain the difference between the two different types of fruit and how they ripen?
Yeah, there are two basic kinds of fruit that we deal with, one of which ripens in a kind of explosive way almost, or a very pronounced way. And those are fruits that just kind of sit there and look like nothing in particular, and then all of a sudden begin to change color and develop aroma. Pears are a good example. Bananas are a good example. Peaches and nectarines and berries and so on have a very short lifespan, and we have to catch them at their peak. They're very good for a very short period of time. Before that, they're not really very interesting. After that, they're just kind of over the hill and not very nice. Then there's another kind of fruit which really doesn't go through that. It ripens very slowly and reaches a kind of plateau and is fine for days, sometimes weeks. And citrus fruits are the best example of those. Apples also keep very well.
And one of the differences between the way the two different types of fruit ripen is ethylene.
That's right. Ethylene is a gas given off by plant cells under various circumstances. Often it's a response to stress or to wounding, and basically speeds up the metabolism of other cells in the neighborhood. And it's very important in ripening because it helps trigger the kind of rapid transformation that we see in fruits that ripen that way. So, for example, if you have a fruit that should ripen that way, a pear or a peach or something like that, and you really want it to go a little faster, you can enclose it in something like a paper bag with, say, a banana that's well along in its ripening because it's giving off ethylene and it can help nudge the other fruit along in its process.
So how is the food industry using this knowledge of ethylene and how it affects ripening? And how is that in turn affecting the taste of our fruits?
Well, it has allowed them to essentially ripen fruits on demand in the supermarket or in transit to the supermarket. So they can therefore pick fruit from the tree or the vine before it's physiologically ripe, before it's actually ripened on its own, transport it while it's still relatively firm and not as fragile as it is when it's ripe, and then either in the truck or at the supermarket, dose it with some ethylene gas to induce ripening now that it's reached its destination. That's very handy for the producer and for the supermarket. It's not so great for the consumer because it means that the fruit has been harvested before it ripened on the vine or the tree, and that means that it's had less time to generate sugars, it's had less time to generate flavor, and it just doesn't taste as good.
My guest is Harold McGee. He's written a new, updated, revised version of his book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, my guest is Harold McGee, and he has a new edition of his popular book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. I don't know if you cook much with microwaves, but what's the difference between how a microwave oven cooks and your stove, and why is it that you can't, or at least I can't, brown food in a microwave, and the food often comes out dry?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly if it's, microwave, you know, like a fish or a meat or something, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and vegetables, too. Microwaves cook in a very different way than ordinary ovens do. Ordinary ovens basically heat the air inside them and radiate heat from their walls and the floor and the ceiling of the oven. And that heat then gets transferred to the outside surface of the food that you put in the oven. And then it gets transferred from the surface of the food to the interior. So the food itself conducts heat from the outside to the inside, and that's the process of cooking. The microwave oven acts very differently. It's sending out electromagnetic radiation, and that radiation turns out to affect really, for the most part, only the water molecules in the food. It really doesn't affect the other molecules, the proteins and the carbohydrates. So what happens is that the electromagnetic radiation from the oven strikes the outside of the food and actually penetrates about an inch into the food before it's dissipated, heats the water molecules in that part of the food, and then the water molecules have to transfer their heat to the other parts of the food. So if a food doesn't have much in the way of water, then it doesn't heat very well. And in fact, if it has water but the water is immobilized, for example, in ice, then it doesn't heat very well. So you can take an ice cube and put it in a microwave oven and turn it on, and nothing much will happen for a long time until the outside begins to melt a little bit just from the warmth of the air. And then the microwaves can affect those water molecules, and then they will begin to affect the rest of the ice cube. The reason that microwave ovens don't brown foods very well is that the microwaves basically affect the water content of the food. And the thing about browning is that it really doesn't begin to happen, those reactions that generate wonderful flavors and colors, until most of the water is boiled off of the surface of the food. And that really never happens in the microwave, or it takes really extended microwave cooking in order to get there. And by the time you've done that, you've turned the food into something like shoe leather.
What do you do to compensate for all the dryness that can result from a microwave oven?
So you can pulse the energy, and that means using a lower power level, and then the microwave is only on for 10 or 15 seconds and then off for 10 or 15 seconds and then on again, and that gives the heat a chance to migrate from the surface to the center and to even out. The other thing you can do is make the atmosphere of the cooking chamber moist. So that, and that does two things. It provides more water molecules for the microwaves to work on and generate heat for the food. And then it provides moisture in the air right around the food so that the food doesn't lose as much water to the air. And so you simply take the care to put a few tablespoons of water into the dish that you're doing the cooking in, and then cover the dish either with another dish or a plate or kind of loose plastic wrap, and that retains the moisture and prevents it from drying out.
Do you use the microwave for defrosting?
I generally don't use the microwave for defrosting.
Is it bad? I mean, does it dry out food in the defrosting process more than just leaving it out would?
Well, yeah, the problem with defrosting is, again, the microwaves are most efficient on water molecules that are free to move. And in fact, that's the way they heat the food, is by making those water molecules that are free to move faster. So in something that's frozen, the water molecules are actually locked up in crystals and are not free to move. And that's why microwaving an ice cube doesn't get you very far. When things do start to melt, then things happen faster. And of course, that's going to happen primarily in a frozen food at the surface. And so what ends up happening often in defrosting is that you, in a microwave, is that you end up partly cooking the very outside while the rest of the food simply thaws. And so you end up with a very uneven result. So I prefer, when it comes to defrosting, to which can take forever in the refrigerator, for example, is just to put the food in a container of ice water. And even though you might think that the warming up is going to be slow because the water is icy, in fact, the water is very efficient at moving heat in and out of various things. It's fluid and it has a high heat capacity and so on. So it actually is a very effective and rapid way of thawing a food, and also thawing it safely, that is to say, keeping the surface at a temperature that isn't going to allow for the growth of bacteria while the rest of the food warms up.
We're warned about a lot of foods having bacteria, so if it's not cooked thoroughly, we'll get food poisoning, and if we don't wash our hands thoroughly after handling it, we can get sick. You hear that particularly discussed around fresh chicken and certain fresh meats. What kind of foods do you feel like you need to take precautions around?
Well, it really is the fresh meats and poultry in particular, because we eat poultry with the skin on, or at least it's packaged much of the time with the skin on, and the skin is going to have the heaviest burden of bacteria of any part of the food. A piece of meat that comes from a healthy animal is going to have its interior is going to be essentially sterile. The interior of the muscle is not going to have any bacteria. The bacteria come from the processing of the meat, and it usually almost exclusively resides on the surface of the food. And that's why it's really important when you're handling food to be careful of both the food surface and any other surfaces that come into contact with it. So the cutting board, the knife, your hands, and also you should be aware that when you cut food up, that you're introducing bacteria from the surface to whatever surface it is you're cutting. So it is just a good idea whenever you're making cooked foods of any kind to make sure that at least the surface of the food gets cooked to the boil or hotter, and that really does take care of most of the risk. For example, hamburger. The thing that makes hamburger risky is that you take a piece of meat that is sterile on the inside but has some bacteria on the surface, and you grind it up, which means that you mix up the inside with the outside, and so you spread whatever bacteria were on the outside throughout the meat. And that's why it's advisable, although not wonderful for the texture of the hamburger, to cook it well all the way through, because the bacteria have been spread all the way through.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harold McGee, and he has a new edition of his popular book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. What do you think of broiling, like broiling steak?
Broiling works very well for very thin pieces of food. And the problem and the advantage both is that the broiler is very, very hot. So you get very high temperatures to develop at the surface of the food very quickly. That means that you develop flavor very quickly, and that's the appeal of grilled and broiled foods in general. The problem is that if the food takes more than a few minutes to cook through, then the outside is going to burn while the inside cooks through. And so there are a couple of ways you can deal with that. One is to broil the outside or grill the outside at a very high temperature very quickly to develop flavor, and then take it from the broiler or the grill and move it to a warm but not super hot place. So the oven or a part of the grill that is at a much lower temperature, and then let the interior cook through much more gently.
How much time should you marinate foods in order to take full advantage of the marinade?
Well, marination is something that generally speaking, only affects the surface of the food. And in fact, the longer the marinade is in contact with the surface of the food, it's true that you get more flavor there, but you can also cause more damage to the structure of the surface. Marinades often contain wine, for example, and wine is acidic, and acids tend to break proteins down. If you leave a piece of meat in a wine marinade for more than a few hours, then the surface ends up kind of mealy because the acid breaks the protein down. And there's a difference, of course, between marinades and brines. Brine is maybe a particular kind of marinade, which is a certain salt concentration that ends up allowing the meat to retain more moisture when it cooks. In the case of a brine, it's important to leave the food in the brine long enough for the brine to penetrate into the food. And so you want meat to stay in a brine longer than you would want it to stay in an acidic marinade.
Harold McGee, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Harold McGee has written a revised edition of his 1984 book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the French fried sauce with the Austin fare, with your fire on the side. I don't want pork chops and bacon that won't awaken my appetite inside. I want the frim frap sauce.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of astrologer Susan Miller's The Year Ahead 2005. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Miriam Taves talks about her new novel. It's based on her experiences growing up in and rebelling against the Mennonite community. Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about the fan mania surrounding the University of Alabama's football team. And David Bianculli reviews the season premieres of Alias and 24. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The season of College Bowl games just ended. Book critic Maureen Corrigan spent the final part of the season with her head in a book.
In a recent book called Available Light, the eminent anthropologist Clifford Geertz poses this central question about the role of judgment in anthropology. What is at stake, Geertz says, is a question that has haunted anthropologists for over 100 years and haunts us even more now that we work in a decolonized world. What are we to make of cultural practices that seem to us odd and illogical? How odd are they? How illogical? In what, precisely, does reason lie? Geertz's answer, as I understand it, is that a responsible anthropologist doesn't impose an outside logic on odd practices. Instead, he or she tries to render those practices according to their own intrinsic logic. That's what Warren St. John does in his new book, Rammer Jammer Yellow Hammer. St. John explores the phenomenon of fan mania in general and the mania surrounding the University of Alabama's football team, the Crimson Tide, in particular. St. John is a reporter for the New York Times, and he's also been a lifelong fan of the Crimson Tide. So as an amateur anthropologist, he's got one foot in, one foot out of the tribe he's studying. A native of Alabama, St. John was initiated into fan manhood at age 13 when he had a one-on-one meeting with the legendary Bama football coach Bear Bryant. In Alabama, where reportedly 90% of the citizens describe themselves as football fans, and 26% associate godlike qualities with the late Coach Bryant, St. John's private audience was akin to being baptized by the Pope. St. John says at the outset of his book, which takes its Jabberwocky-ish title from an old Alabama fight song, that he had a moment of reckoning about football a few years ago in which he asked himself the soul-searching question of, why do I care? Rammer Jammer Yellow Hammer is St. John's attempt to explore the mystery of extreme fandom by completely surrendering himself to it for a season. He takes a leave of absence from his job and eventually even buys a crummy used RV so that he can really be one with the legion of party-hardy Crimson Tide fans who park their mobile homes at stadium football lots the Wednesday before a Saturday game. His book is indeed part amateur anthropology, part new journalism, and it's thoroughly fun to read. At this point, the expected thing for a non-football fan like me to also say about a book like this is that it made me get sports mania in a way I never have before. But actually it didn't, and that's to its credit. Implicitly following in the footsteps of Clifford Geertz, Warren St. John doesn't attempt to translate the cultural practices of rabid Alabama football fans in ways that render them familiar to an outsider. Instead, St. John grants these fans the dignity of their otherness. Or, to put it in plainer, politically incorrect language, these fans are nuts, and St. John vividly, but without condescension, presents them in the full frenzy of their nuthood. If that sounds harsh, consider the evidence. Among the folks St. John visits or lives alongside in these Bedouin football caravans are a couple who deliberately skipped their own daughter's wedding because it conflicted with a Bama game. Then there's the mother-daughter cheerleading team known as the Huggers, who spend the season ambushing the Crimson Tide players in hotel lobbies and hugging them. St. John makes a pilgrimage to a funeral home that sells Alabama coffins, big red fiberglass boxes with white velvet A's sewn into the lids. The oddest detail, St. John says, is that the coffin is affixed with a small round sticker that reads, "Officially licensed collegiate product," the same one you find affixed to sweatshirts and baseball caps. And then there's the fan known admiringly as Heart Guy to the rest of the community of RV Crimson Tide followers. When St. John meets him, Heart Guy is wearing a beeper, not because he's on call for work, but because he's awaiting a heart transplant. The hitch is that if Heart Guy travels outside of a 2-hour radius from the transplant hospital in Nashville, as he does regularly to follow Alabama games, he's automatically bumped from the life-saving transplant list. As Heart Guy explains, if you can't go to Alabama football games, what's the point in living? For a non-sports fan, the experience of reading Rammer Jammer Yellow Hammer is akin to what I imagine swimming with dolphins would be like. You inhabit a strange world for a space where the language and customs are odd but riveting. To an extent, you know that community from the inside, but you're not of it. You return to terra firma, happy that you've taken this excursion into the world of the other, but immensely relieved that you don't live there.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Rammer Jammer Yellow Hammer, A Journey into the Heart of Fan Mania by Warren St. John. Coming up, Miriam Taves talks about growing up in a fundamentalist Mennonite community yearning to get out. It's the subject of her new autobiographical novel. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ Miriam Taves grew up in a fundamentalist Mennonite community in a small town in Manitoba, Canada. But she dreamed of living in Greenwich Village, which represented everything her town was not. Her new novel, A Complicated Kindness, is based on her experiences as a teenager. Reviewing it in the Toronto Star, Noah Richler described it as a truly wonderful novel. He wrote, "Taves recreates the stultifying world of an exasperated Mennonite teenager in a small town where nothing happens, with mesmerizing authenticity." Here's a short reading from the beginning of the novel.
"People here just can't wait to die, it seems. It's the main event. The only reason we're not all snuffed at birth is because that would reduce our suffering by a lifetime. My guidance counselor has suggested to me that I change my attitude about this place and learn to love it. But I do, I told her. Oh, that's rich, she said. That's rich. We're Mennonites. As far as I know, we're the most embarrassing subsect of people to belong to if you're a teenager. 500 years ago in Europe, a man named Menno Simon set off to do his own peculiar religious thing, and he and his followers were beaten up and killed or forced to conform all over Holland, Poland, and Russia until they, at least some of them, finally landed right here where I sit. Ironically, they named this place East Village, which, I have learned, is the name of the area in New York City that I would most love to inhabit."
That's Miriam Taves reading from her new novel, A Complicated Kindness. Miriam, what is the preoccupation with death that you describe in this novel? You write, when your character says, "When we were little, my sister and I would sit in the darkened dining room of my grandmother's farmhouse, listening to the funeral announcements. They came on after supper on the local radio station we were allowed to listen to, because the elders knew that it was better for little children to listen to the names of dead people being read out in a terrifying monotone than the Beatles singing 'All We Need Is Love.'" Was there a radio program like that that you listened to?
Yeah, there was, actually. That part is something that I took straight from my own life. My parents would listen to the death announcements, you know. Not sure if it was every day or every week, because there was always somebody that they, you know, they would have known, somebody who had died, some older man or woman. And so, you know, it was a small community. So this was something that they listened to with great interest. And you know, because I was there, I would hear it too. But that would, and, you know, and certainly, yeah, we weren't listening to, you know, we weren't listening to the Beatles or any pop or rock and roll, really, when I was younger. When I got older and when my sister was older too, when we became teenagers, you know, we acquired records and stuff like that. But before that, yeah, basically the radio that we listened to would have been death announcements.
What were some of the things that were banned in your community?
It wasn't so much that it was that things were formally banned, but certainly, you know, the whole gamut of drinking, smoking, dancing was strictly forbidden. Playing cards, gambling, you know, and with some of the more conservative congregations, because there are different degrees of conservatism within the Mennonite church, but the very conservative congregations, you know, would have banned, for instance, fancy appliances in the home, or, you know, a soft top car, for instance, you know, just fanciness that could be portrayed by others as vanity and worldliness. You know, those were the things that Mennonites were expected to stay away from.
Did you rebel against it?
You know, I came from quite a tolerant, sort of liberal Mennonite home. My family was quite tolerant and liberal, and you know, didn't come down hard on me for much of anything at all. But I grew up in a very conservative Mennonite community, and so I saw that type of rebellion. I think I did typical stuff, you know, just drinking, smoking, whatever it was. But I wasn't full of anger. I wasn't full of rage, and I didn't feel that I was being crushed in the same way that maybe my characters might feel, or that I've seen, you know, around me.
You left your community when you were 18.
Mm-hmm.
You say that one of the reasons why you needed to leave is that you wanted to write. Could you not have written fiction in this community, do you think?
No, not the type of fiction that I write. Not fiction that would have been critical, you know, of the community, of the power structure, of the sort of oppressiveness of it. I mean, no, I mean, I could have. I wouldn't have been, you know, run out of town or anything, but it would have been very, very difficult to live there. That whole idea of you know, of shunning, which is something that Mennonites, again, the conservative Mennonites still do. They may not call it shunning anymore, but it certainly looks and feels and acts exactly like shunning.
Describe what shunning is.
Well, shunning was a Mennonite thing that, you know, if you broke the laws of the church, you know, which were, and again, these were, again, interpreted sort of subjectively and arbitrarily by, at least as far as I could tell, by the powers that be, by the church elders, by the ministers, by the deacons. Though, you know, adultery, for instance, or, you know, or any number of things, you know, drinking or something. The community would basically shun you, literally. I mean, there would be silence all around. In fact, your own spouse would be expected not to have anything to do with you, not to sleep with you, not to eat with you. You would live in the same home, but there wouldn't be any communication. Essentially, you'd be cut off. You know, you would be isolated, and that's an extremely destructive thing. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, that it's a form of psychological torture, essentially. I mean, that sounds extreme, but I know that, you know, I know the damage that it's done. I know individuals who have been shunned and who are still, you know, kind of, I mean, that's a devastating thing to have happen to you.
Who in your life was shunned?
My great-grandfather was shunned for a period of time for eloping with a 17-year-old girl after his wife died. You know, the children of some of my mom's friends have been shunned for instance, babies born out of wedlock, and then, you know, years and years and years and years later, some of them are forgiven and allowed to, you know, to re-enter the church, and that often means an awful lot to them. Sometimes it doesn't mean anything. Sometimes these people go off and you know, and leave for good and do their own thing, but sometimes they don't. You know, they stay in the community and sort of exist as outsiders.
You make the Mennonite culture sound very unforgiving.
You know, I don't mean to make the Mennonite culture seem unforgiving, because it's not unforgiving in all respects. There are elements that are unforgiving and intolerant and unloving, and there are many, many elements that are exactly the opposite, that are forgiving, that are tolerant, that are loving, that are truly loving. But certainly from what I've experienced, from the characters in my book experience, you know, there is a lot of you know, unforgiving, intolerant attitudes that are destructive and that are unnecessary and that aren't Christian and that, you know, I don't know. It's difficult, you know, because I mean, I still consider myself to be a Mennonite. My mother's a Mennonite, belongs to a Mennonite church. You know, some of my closest friends are Mennonites. I'm married to a Mennonite. You know, I consider my children to be Mennonite. It's not something that I, you know, that I eschew, you know, or deny or you know, have turned my back on. But it's something that I'm critical of in certain ways.
Now, where do you live now?
I live in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
In a city or in a small town?
Yeah, it's a city. Yeah, it's a city. It's a half million, over half a million.
And where you were from had how many people?
When I was a kid, about 6,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was some of the most challenging parts of leaving a very homogenous religious community to go into a city?
I was so excited when I left. I moved actually immediately from my hometown, which is called Steinbeck. I moved to Montreal, which, as you probably know, is a very cosmopolitan, you know, large urban center here in Canada, in the east and in Quebec. And so I went there directly to study French, actually, which was another thing that was kind of, you know, poo-pooed in my community. A German would have been the language, or Low German, Plattdeutsch, actually. But I wanted to study French, and I wanted to live in Montreal, and it was hard. I mean, I did feel like a bit of a, you know, a nerd, a bit of a dork, a bit of an outsider. I didn't think I was very cool, and I'm sure a lot of other people agreed. You know, and then, you know, eventually, I mean, I'm still, now I've lived in the city for, well, you know, like 20 years, but you know, I still feel like I still miss my hometown. I still think of it fondly. I still think of my childhood, which is a wonderful time in my life. It was very nurturing. I felt very safe. Everybody knew who I was, what church I went to, who my grandparents were, who my parents were, you know, what the part of Russia my you know, specific great grandparents came from. You know, I mean, it was just, and I still miss it, you know. And it's only 40 miles down the road, and but I don't have anybody there anymore. My dad died, my mom moved to the city, my sister lives in the city. You know, it's kind of, I have some old aunts who I love dearly, but, you know, don't see very often. I don't know, it kind of lives on in my, you know, in my memory as not that bad a place.
You have three children, all teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Are you bringing them up within the religion?
No, no, not at all. You know, we it's kind of, you know, I mean, how does a Mennonite define him or herself as a Mennonite? It's kind of, you know, I consider myself to be a Mennonite. My husband, I consider him to be a Mennonite, but he doesn't really think of himself as a Mennonite because he's never belonged to any church. And, you know, the kids, because of their last names here in this in this city, everybody knows, you know, what Mennonites are and who Mennonites are and what they're kind of about. And so because of our last name, it's clearly a Mennonite last name. And so they would be considered to be Mennonites. But no, they don't go to a Mennonite church. Again, my mother is, you know, part of a Mennonite church. And she, you know, she you know, certainly wields a type of influence on them, which is a positive, loving Mennonite thing.
What are some of the values or other aspects of the Mennonite religion that you still really like?
I like the whole idea of community. I like the idea of, you know, large extended families of, you know, I mean, I have over 30 first cousins. So, you know, I mean, I don't even know my second cousins. Second cousins are somebody, you know, that basically within the Mennonite culture aren't even considered really relatives. Just, you know, my parents were second cousins, actually. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of funny. You know, one of my best friend is actually my second cousin, but we never think of each other as second cousins because that's so sort of, you know, there are way too many first cousins that count as more immediate family. But no, I miss that. You know, I miss that whole, and to a certain degree, I still have it. You know, I mean, certainly on my mother's side, you know, we'll get together, all the cousins and stuff, you know, every few years, and they come from all over, and we'll have a good time. But yeah, so there's that. There's I'm still eating a lot of the Mennonite food. You know, my mom prepares it, I prepare it. What I do miss, something that I do miss, and is the singing. Mennonites are known for their singing, for their a cappella singing in harmony, in four part harmony. It's very moving. You know, I have to stop myself from crying because it's so beautiful to me, and I remember that very fondly.
Your parents were second cousins.
I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. Yeah, my sister and I are reasonably normal.
Are there any taboos against second cousins marrying?
Apparently not. No, there aren't. I mean, nowadays, although I know younger people too who are second cousins and married, but no, I don't think there is a taboo. Is there some kind of law against it? There is certainly a taboo against first cousins getting married. I know that.
I guess, you know, it's possible that there could be, like, health issues, like, you know, genetically
passed on
health issues when there's, you know, marriage within the extended family like that.
Absolutely. Well, it's kind of interesting. I and my sister-in-law are, we are second cousins. So that's, okay, so my husband's brother's wife and I are second cousins. So that our kids, actually, her kids and my kids are first cousins because their dads are brothers, but they're also third cousins, right? I think because their mom and I are second cousins, which sounds pretty freaky. It's kind of embarrassing to say, but you know, it seems to have all worked out more or less.
Your new novel is set in the kind of community that you grew up in, a small Mennonite community in Canada. Do you want to write about other places, or do you want to keep your writing to the type of community that you're from and that you know so well?
I really want to write about other places. I think it's I really feel that, you know, I've said a lot of what I know, that, you know, your background, the place where you're from and all of that stuff will seep into, you know, it'll seep into your work, you know, forever, right? I mean, it always does. I mean, that's unavoidable. But I definitely want to move on, and I've lived in other places. I've traveled around the world and you know, I think it's definitely time, and I'm looking forward to writing about other places.
Well, Miriam Taves, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was nice. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Miriam Taves' new novel is called A Complicated Kindness. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the season premieres of Alias and 24. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The high-action drama series Alias returns to TV tonight, and on Sunday, 24 begins another season. TV critic David Bianculli has been waiting eagerly for both of them and has this review.
Two action dramas return to TV this week. There's Kiefer Sutherland saving the day, 1 hour at a time, on 24, and Jennifer Garner saving the world, one wig at a time, on Alias. And they have an awful lot in common. They have very attractive leads who shoulder the majority of the screen time. They move at a relentless pace. There's always a question about whom to trust, even among their fellow spies and loved ones. And every once in a while, both shows reinvent themselves by shaking things up entirely. Alias did it last year, after two seasons in which Jennifer Garner, as CIA agent Sidney Bristow, seemed to have settled into her world of espionage. She had made peace with her parents and bonded with a boyfriend, all of whom were fellow spies. Life seemed good. So series creator J.J. Abrams shook the show's foundations and Sidney's world by starting last season with a 2-year fast-forward. Sidney woke up in the Far East with no memory of those 2 years, and with all her loved ones presuming her dead. Her boyfriend had married another woman, and the entire season was a quest for Sidney to find her past, her place, and herself. On 24, every new day, each 24-episode cycle of hour-long real-time installments, has started with Kiefer Sutherland's Jack in a new place. This year, the story picks up 18 months later, and Jack starts off far away from the pressure cooker world of CTU, the counterterrorist unit. In the interim, he was dismissed from his job by the agency's new boss, and he's enjoying a quieter life with his new girlfriend. Her father, played by William Devane, happens to be Secretary of State, and in the opening hour of 24, he and his daughter are kidnapped by Middle Eastern terrorists. Needless to say, Jack is on the case, with or without official approval. And with the new CTU boss Aaron Driscoll being the one who fired Jack for being a heroin addict, he's not likely to get that approval. Alberta Watson, who played a similarly flinty spy boss on the TV version of La Femme Nikita, plays Aaron.
Aaron, I need to speak to you.
You're done here, Jack.
Just listen to me.
I'm detaining you.
Aaron, just listen to me. Secretary Heller is my responsibility. Now I need you to reinstate me on a provisional basis until I get him back.
You don't give me orders, Jack. I'm detaining you until an investigator from division can take your statement. I'm going to recommend that you be arrested for torturing a suspect and rendering him useless for questioning.
You weren't getting anywhere with him. Because of me, Sherrick told you everything he knows.
You better hope so. Would you please escort Mr. Bauer to a vacant office until division gets here?
I'm fine. You're making a mistake.
The new year of 24 begins strongly, and William Devane, as the kidnapped Secretary of State, matches Sutherland in intensity and magnetic screen presence. The first 4 hours move swiftly, even in real time, and I can't wait to see more. As for the new Alias, the shift this year is a major effort to not only change things, but simplify them. Before the 2-hour season premiere is over, Sidney has walked away from her old job and colleagues at the CIA. But, as with Jack Bauer on 24, circumstances and fate dictate that she doesn't go far. This 2-hour Alias premiere isn't as strong as previous season openers, but it has a lot to accomplish and a lot of exposition to get through. And as revisionist history goes, it's a lot more satisfying than having Bobby Ewing step out of the shower, as he did on Dallas, to announce that the entire previous season was a dream. The dream for Alias is its new time slot. J.J. Abrams' drama never found the audience it deserved on Sunday nights. But now that his other primetime drama, Lost, is one of the season's biggest hits, ABC is rewarding Abrams by moving Alias to Wednesdays following Lost, hoping viewers will stay tuned for both shows. 24 also starts the season with an expanded premiere, 2 hours Sunday, two more on Monday. Then, like Alias, it moves to a new night, and will be shown Mondays at 9. Both of these are smart scheduling moves, especially since the mid-season starts for these shows guarantee that they'll finish out the season without interruption. No repeats, no preemptions. Just two really good shows every week. Shows that seem even better when surrounded by such hideous mid-season reality series as Who's Your Daddy and The Will. Welcome back, Jack and Sidney. It's been a long wait, but it's worth it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Mapmaker's Wife, a true tale of love, murder, and survival in the Amazon by Robert Whitaker. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Washington Post reporter Michael Dobbs. He was vacationing on a small island off the coast of Sri Lanka when the tsunami hit. We'll also talk with his brother Jeffrey Dobbs, a businessman who owns that island and is now helping with relief efforts. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.